From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On our show today, Michigan's Attorney General takes aim on human traffickers.
The fact is, this whole issue of human trafficking needs to stop in Michigan, and the more we talk about it, the more we work with local prosecutors and law enforcement, the better off our state will be.
Plus, will Michigan be helped by opening the door to more foreign workers with science and tech skills?
In Michigan alone, 33% of our tech companies were founded by immigrants, and that's just a really vital statistic that we can't afford to ignore.
And how the U.S. compares to other affluent nations in terms of health. It's not a comparison that does us proud.
If you look at the age-specific mortality rates, the U.S. is systematically at the bottom of that list. I mean, number 15, 16, 17.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new report finds Americans are less healthy than our international peers. Why are we falling behind? On today's show, we explore America's health disparities. And should Michigan recruit more skilled foreign workers? One immigration lawyer in West Michigan says there just are not enough workers for STEM jobs, those in science and technology, both in our state and in the country. So are foreign workers really taking those STEM jobs away from Americans? But first, when you hear the term human trafficking, and let yourself think about what that entails, you might think of it as something happening overseas, perhaps in exotic places. You would be very wrong. Human trafficking happens in the United States, and it is happening right here in the Great Lakes State. Michigan's Attorney General Bill Schuette says, you can bet that human beings are being sold for profit in our state, and he's marshaling his resources to fight back against human trafficking. Attorney General Bill Schuette joins us now. Welcome.
Cynthia, it's great to be with you on Stateside, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this big problem of human trafficking, which is a key priority for me, and I think it is of keen interest to people across our state of Michigan.
Well, Mr. Attorney General, you created the first ever human trafficking unit in the AG's office. What led you to take that step?
Well, you know, it was part of a kind of an educational model and some great conversations I had with Bridget Carr from the University of Michigan and Jane White at MSU. And these two individuals, Bridget and Jane, head up human trafficking task forces at University of Michigan and Michigan State University, respectively, and met with them and dug deep into this issue about human trafficking. And it's a shocker that in the 21st century you'd have young women, could be Michigan citizens, could be foreign nationals, that are forced into labor enslavement or prostitution and held against their will, a modern-day bondage issue of enslavement for forced labor or prostitution. And that this is happening in the 21st century is outrageous. And so I said, okay, Michigan needs to do something about it. And we've had five convictions now, more in the pipeline. And the fact is, this whole issue of human trafficking needs to stop in Michigan. And the more we talk about it, the more we work with local prosecutors and law enforcement officials, the better off our state will be.
Is there any way at all to know how prevalent human trafficking is in Michigan? Because it is such a secret, out-of-sight crime.
Well, you know, it's we work on that a lot, and particularly with law enforcement officials and prosecutors and our investigators here at the Attorney General's office. We're very focused on it. You know what? I think the key thing is the more you work on it, the more you emphasize it, I think the better off everybody is. And, you know, some people say, oh, gee, this is just, you know, prostitution's been going on for years and years and years. That's not what this is about. This is about young girls who become enticed or forced, held captive in many instances against their will, that are forced to work in employment situations and or prostitution. And, you know, that's just as a father, my wife and I have a father of a daughter, it makes your stomach just turn and churn. And so the fact is, This is an effort that I want to partner with law enforcement officials across the state of Michigan and alert the public and say, okay, what can we do to stop this? One thing I'm going to do is I have legislation that we're going to introduce this year that increases the crime for forcing young girls into this this whole gruesome situation by increasing that to a felony instead of a misdemeanor.
It's amazing that it was a misdemeanor.
Right. Well, it's, again, this is about, we have to alert people to this. You got to drive the message home. And so the penalty for soliciting sex from a 16 to 18-year-old now is a misdemeanor, and it needs to be a five-year felony. So that's what I'm going to work on.
As you've prosecuted these cases, you say you've had five convictions now with the Human Trafficking Unit. Give us an idea of just how this crime happens. How do these young people become victims based on what you, especially you've gotten an intimate sense of how it happens through these prosecutions?
Well, one of our cases occurred in Detroit, and the nickname of this guy was named Gruesome, and he truly was. He lived up to that name. And he exploited two runaway teenagers, enslaving them in a house in Detroit where they were sold for sex. And when they resisted, they were sexually and physically assaulted. We're talking about a 14- or 15-year-old girl here. Mm-hmm. These are children. And now, fortunately, a jury convicted this guy Gruesome of human trafficking, among other charges, and now he's serving a 35- to 60-year sentence in prison where he belongs. There is a second case involving a prostitution ring called Detroit Pink, and we charged five individuals for the roles, and that's in the pipeline now and within the legal process. So we, our investigators, we work with local prosecutors, we find this out, and then we just kind of go just like a heat-seeking missile to try to say, okay, we want to put an end to this and want to file charges.
What do you feel, Mr. Attorney General, can be done on the front end of things, especially awareness for parents? We talked with Teresa Flores, who's a leading human. She was a victim of human trafficking, and now she's. I know you're aware of her work, and the thought that was happening to her as she was living her life at home, going to and from classes, and feeling unable to tell her parents. I think there's something that parents need to know and to be aware of, so perhaps it could be stopped on the front end.
And I've met with Teresa, and she has a very compelling story because she was a Michigan girl, so to speak, and went through just a brutal situation. And I think this issue of communication with parents and children is a fundamental issue. It's sometimes you have to talk about subjects that aren't the most pleasant, but they're real, and you need to have these discussions. And so the more you have openness and transparency between parents and children, I think the stronger the family is. And it's kind of like we do a lot of we have a Michigan CSI program, Cynthia, that is stands for Cyber Safety Initiative. It's kind of like, Miami CSI, but except for real. And the fact is we talk with parents and kids in schools about the importance of being safe on the Internet. And this is all one of these communication things as well. You always have your computer don't have it tucked away in a basement, in a corner of a bedroom. Have that computer in the middle of the kitchen area or something like that. And I use that as an example of the more you talk, the more you communicate, the more you're open about what's going on in school, what's happening in the news, what's going on with you, and be intentional about having those discussions. I think that's a front end answer to your question.
And certainly, as you alluded to, human trafficking really is as old as mankind. But I'd like your thoughts on how the Internet has changed the game, not only for the traffickers, but for those of you trying to find them and arrest them.
Well, it's interesting. Yes, prostitution, as you said, has been going on for, decades and decades and years. But this issue of human trafficking really is focuses on and preys upon young ladies, and the whole issue of the Internet and Backpage and some of these operators online, they try to hide behind the First Amendment and freedom of expression and speech in newspapers, where they advertise back pages and some of these, I think, shady outfits, where they, you know, look, they have want ads, so to speak, but they're really just a guise for those who want to trap and then later enslave and have young girls be prostitutes, and then they force them in a way that, you know, they, you know, have them enslaved in a place or a room or a house or something like that when they try to have one of these employment situations. So the internet as a tool of education and information also can be just as bad as taking a wrong turn in a bad part of town. So everybody's got to be careful out there.
Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Great to be with you. Thank you very much.
You can learn more about human trafficking in Michigan by going to michigan.gov/human trafficking, all one word. We'll put a link to that site up on our website at michiganradio.org. And if you're a victim of human trafficking or you see someone you think may need help, the National Human Trafficking Resource Center has a toll-free hotline. It's open 24/7. That number, 888-373-7888. That's 888-373-7888, and we will put that number up on our website as well for you. News out today. Michigan's Democratic congressional delegation wants to replace the longtime chairman of the state Democratic Party. Senators Carl Levin, Debbie Stabenow, and five members of the U.S. House wrote an open letter today backing Lon Johnson over incumbent Mark Brewer. Brewer has served as Democratic Party chair in Michigan for 18 years and hopes to be reelected later this month. But support for from some heavy hitters is growing for Johnson, who lost a state House election in northern Michigan in November. President Obama and Senator Debbie Stabenow won in Michigan in 2012. But Republicans kept control of the state House, and congressional Democrats are not happy about losses at state and local levels that culminated with the passage of the new right to work law. We love hearing what you have to say. You can connect with us very easily. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Go to the Stateside link. Go to Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Or we can go to Twitter at Stateside Radio. So many of us love those Laura Ingalls Wilder Little House books. Well, now there's a new look at just what might have caused Laura's sister Mary to go blind. We'll talk with the U of M pediatric professor who did all the medical detective work to find the real cause. It's a story that's caught the attention of the nation, and it's coming up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Are there important jobs going begging in Michigan? Jobs that fall under the umbrella of STEM jobs, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics-based jobs? Well, it's accepted virtually everywhere that STEM jobs are crucial for innovation and economic growth. A major study in 2011 by Georgetown University examined the importance of these STEM jobs, and it projected by 2018 there'll be 2.4 million job openings for workers with STEM degrees, and it predicts American businesses won't be able to fill the openings with U.S. graduates alone. My next guest believes that one important way to help fill those jobs in engineering, math, computer science, design, building and construction, physical sciences, and more would be to lower the barriers keeping immigrants with this vital STEM talent from coming here to America. Susan M. is an immigration attorney in Grand Rapids. Her recent piece in the Grand Rapids Business Journal asked the question, do immigration barriers stifle entrepreneurship and our vital STEM workforce? She's also the chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association Michigan chapter, and Susan joins us now from Grand Rapids. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Well, that Georgetown study, Susan, looking at education and jobs, really seemed very clear that our education system is not turning out enough STEM-capable students to meet those demand for those traditional STEM jobs or the kinds of jobs that would demand the core skills and competencies that STEM workers possess. So you would argue that letting in more immigrant STEM workers wouldn't take jobs away from American workers?
I would. I would, because I work with U.S. employers, many of them Michigan employers, on a regular basis, Cynthia, to obtain the work visas for these highly skilled foreign nationals. And I know from my experience that these U.S. employers would love to fill the positions with U.S. grads. It certainly would be less time-consuming. They could cut out the bureaucratic headaches of dealing with our immigration service, and they wouldn't have to pay immigration attorney fees. But they don't have a choice. There just aren't enough U.S. grads or skilled workers to fill the positions.
How does that, in your view, impact the economic recovery of Michigan and really the prospects for future growth?
Well, Cynthia, you may have heard, you know, our own Governor Snyder, you know, talking about, you know, being really the most pro-immigrant governor in the United States, and I really admire his stances that he's taken on immigration, you know, given that this has been such a hot-button topic. But I would tell you that immigrants create jobs. You don't have to look much further than, you know, our history of these Google, Intech, eBay. I mean, these are household American brands and names, and they were founded by immigrants or the children of immigrants. So we've got, in Michigan alone, 33% of our tech companies were founded by immigrants, and that's just a really vital statistic that we can't afford to ignore.
So it sounds like there would be a twofold benefit. One, that existing companies would be able to have the STEM-based workers, STEM-skilled workers that they need, and also that these folks coming in kind of possess that entrepreneurial drive, so you'd also be creating new companies and therefore new jobs.
Exactly. It's both.
Well, some critics argue that foreign-born STEM workers are driving American workers out of those jobs because those foreign nationals would accept lower wages. How do you answer that?
Well, I would first answer that it's a myth, because number one, the folks that we are working with these U.S. employers, many of them Michigan employers, again, they're not doing this because they want to do it. They don't want to go through a very laborious and expensive U.S. immigration process just to do it. They're doing it because they have to do it. And as part of that process, Cynthia, there are minimum prevailing wage requirements that U.S. employers must meet in order to even petition for these foreign national workers. So I would argue right then and there, you can't get away with it. You can't pull the wool over DOL and USCIS's eyes in terms of being able to pay these foreign nationals what they have to be paid, what similarly situated U.S. workers are being paid. Of course, there are always bad apples or people that aren't playing by the rules in any segment of the population, but the statistics show that the amount of fraud that's happening, for instance, in the H-1B work visa arena is extremely low.
And when we talk about these types of jobs that are needed by workers with STEM skills, what kinds of jobs are we talking about?
You know, it's really quite wide-ranging, Cynthia. Mm-hmm. Gone are the days where it's just simply the researchers and the scientists. It's really broadened, and what we're contacted by U.S. employers for work visas and green cards are for, you know, STEM occupations that really go beyond that traditional research scientist. Of course, we still have those requests, but we also have requests for architects and all sorts of computer IT specialist positions, ranging from systems analysts to database analysts to programmers and software engineers.
You talk in your piece about the immigration barriers. So
yeah,
give us some specific sense of what these barriers are. How, in your view, is the current immigration system broken?
There's a couple of things that some folks may have heard about. We have, you know, the most common professional specialty occupation work visa is known as the H-1B. It sounds like a disease, but it's not. We only have 65,000 slots available per fiscal year, with only 20,000 additional slots allocated for people that hold U.S. master's degree. Those slots run out so quickly after they become available. In fact, last year it was they ran out, I think, 10 weeks after they became available, and we all know that this year it's going to be even worse. And so right then and there we can see that if these type of H-1Bs that are used a lot by STEM workers or folks with STEM core competencies, because we're not graduating enough U.S. Students to fill those type of positions, they're just being used up too ridiculously quickly. And with employers having to pay major premium fees to the government just to file an H-1B, they don't want to do this if they didn't have to do it. And when we're seeing them run out so quickly, that's a major barrier. But there are other major barriers that you may not have heard of, folks may not have heard of. We're dealing right now with a culture of no at our U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service Centers, despite the talk about comprehensive immigration reform that's becoming very popular in D.C. right now, and that's encouraging. A lot of folks do not know how difficult it is for U.S. employers legitimately needing to bring over, whether it's their highly skilled managers and executives from abroad, from a corporately related entity, or it's folks trying to petition for a highly skilled STEM worker.
What do you think is behind the culture of no? Give us some for instances.
Oh boy, the downturn of the economy. We have seen a very protective attitude from some of the officers at USCIS. And while we understand where that is coming from, that is not their role. Their role is to decide whether or not an employer meets the legal requirements for that particular work visa category under the statute and regulations, not we've got these issues with our U.S. economy, and this person is on its face just not eligible to come because they're going to take a job away from a U.S. worker. That attitude, that protective attitude, is bleeding into the decisions, and we're seeing some very poorly written decisions coming from USCIS on work visa petitions where these are employers just banging their heads against a wall saying, if I could hire a U.S. worker, Susan, I would. I can't. And they've done, some of them, significant recruitment efforts that we document in the filings of the petitions to the government just to show them.
We should also note that when we refer to the USCIS, it's the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service.
Yes.
And
yes.
Those service centers are kind of the place. It sounds like you're feeling that the logjam is happening. What's a typical wait? How long might some of these foreign nationals who have these STEM skills wait to be able to get the green card status and get that visa?
Well, boy, green card status is a whole nother issue. But I would tell you that they are waiting a very long time. Assuming the STEM worker or the entrepreneur is lucky enough to be approved for a work visa, which can take several months. If they're lucky, it might be less than that, but it can also take several months, assuming that it even gets approved. Once they're here, in order to keep them here, the employer.
What's a typical cap, Susan?
Yeah, for an H-1B, it's 6 years.
Okay.
For an L-1 intra-company transfer of a manager or executive, it would be 7 years. The only way to keep that valued foreign worker here is to pursue a very laborious green card process. And so circling back to your question, mm-hmm. Cynthia, some of these foreign nationals, particularly those that are born in India and China, they are waiting 5, 8, 10+ years to attain green card status, and oftentimes we're losing some of those foreign nationals to countries with more competitive immigration laws because they just don't want to stick around and wait, or their spouses and their children have no ability to get work authorization while they're waiting out this very long time frame.
Susan M., as an immigration attorney, what solutions would you be calling for, first of all, in terms of reforming our visa system?
Well, you know, you hit it right on the button, Cynthia. The first thing we need to do is, you know, while security is important, building more walls isn't going to solve this problem. We need better laws. We need to take a look at this particular STEM population and the entrepreneurs that are looking to come here, invest in the United States, and create jobs. We need to have a legal visa category that's created for entrepreneurs and investors, aside from our one category that we have, known as an E2 visa category, which isn't even available to all countries, particularly India and China. So we need visa categories that are targeted toward these highly qualified individuals who are proven entrepreneurs, proven folks that create jobs.
In terms of just the way that we as American citizens, as citizens of Michigan, view these immigrant workers, these foreign nationals, what would you like to see changed in that?
I would love to see. In fact, I feel that our economic recovery and success in Michigan and everywhere in the United States is dependent on a fresh view of immigrants, not looking at it as a we versus them. It can be win-win, particularly if you look at the contributions of immigrants.
Susan Im is an immigration attorney in Grand Rapids. Her recent piece in the Grand Rapids Business Journal entitled, Do Immigration Barriers Stifle Entrepreneurship and Our Vital STEM Workforce? And we have put links to your article and also to that major study done by Georgetown University examining the importance of these STEM jobs and the need for workers with these core STEM skills. Susan, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, hands up. How many of you read The Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder? Well, my hand is up. I can tell you from the time my third grade teacher, Mrs. Syme, began reading us Little House in the Big Woods, I was totally hooked. And those of us who read those books, who can forget opening up by the shores of Silver Lake and reading these words? Here's the quote. Mary and Carrie and baby Grace and Ma all had scarlet fever. Far worst of all, the fever had settled in Mary's eyes and Mary was blind. Dr. Beth Tarini read those words when she was a little girl, and she remembered them years later when she was in medical school, and that set her on some medical detective work. The assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Michigan is making headlines all over the nation as she published a report in the journal Pediatrics with what she believes really made Mary Ingalls go blind. And Dr. Beth Tarini joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Well, it's obvious that that stunning beginning of By the Shores of Silver Lake stuck in your mind as well. And what, it was a conversation with one of your med school professors that got you thinking what?
Thinking, how could this be, on both sides. So I, like many medical students, was sitting around a table going through my pediatrics clerkship, and we were talking about scarlet fever. And I just raised my hand and said, oh, scarlet fever can make you go blind, right? And the professor sort of stopped and said, no, I don't think so. I've never seen that before and never heard of it. And I said with such certainty, well, but Mary Ingalls went blind. And I had read the books and it had come back to me. And it obviously, as you say, resonated with me and
yes.
It stayed with me. And you can see the professor sort of knew of the story and hesitated because knew Mary Ingalls was also a real person.
Right.
And said, I still don't think so. But I wasn't satisfied with that answer and so went off my own to find out what really happened.
So you did medical detective work. What,
yes.
what did you do?
So I went wandering around the stacks of the medical school, looking, dusting off and old medical textbooks from the era, trying to find out if, in fact, there had ever been reports or descriptions of scarlet fever causing blindness. And I'd find occasional reports of blindness, but it was often temporary, rarely permanent. At the same time, I was looking into the source for the book and then uncovered the fact that these books, as many know, are autobiographical fiction and are based on memoirs,
right.
Which themselves are written years later. And so then went to the original memoirs called Pioneer Girl to find what had Laura penned initially before those books were even published.
And what had she written?
She had written about an experience in which Mary goes blind, and she writes with, first of all, much more detail than what you see in the book.
Sure.
And she also writes with a notable absence and presence of symptoms which are not in the book. For example, there is no mention of a rash. In addition, she writes about a fever, and she writes about a headache. The headache doesn't come into the book at all. And interestingly enough, she writes about a stroke, what she calls a stroke, describing then that one side of Mary's face droops, which is interesting for numerous reasons. First, not necessarily a common association one would put with scarlet fever. Second, the stroke is not necessarily itself a common association with a febrile illness. Interestingly enough, when you go to the newspapers of that time, you find that, in fact, she, in local newspapers, was written to have a stroke. But when you look at the actual description,
right.
what they call to be a stroke is only a one side of the face droop, which is not what the sort of normal person, average Joe, would call a stroke of an older person that loses function, able to walk and talk at the same time. So it actually turns out to be not a stroke, as people think classically, comes in the brain, but a nerve paralysis that's happening outside of the brain.
Okay. So your medical diagnostician sleuth work turned out the diagnosis of?
Meningoencephalitis, likely.
And that is something that we see today, isn't it?
Yes. You'll see it today. You'll see cases of meningitis and encephalitis, or a combination of the two, which would be meningoencephalitis. You won't see it as commonly as you will see strep throat, or you will see scarlet fever, but you definitely see them today.
You kind of have a deeper meaning or deeper message to physicians from your paper in the journal Pediatrics. What does it say to pediatricians about the way parents may receive a diagnosis you hand down?
Right. I mean, I think that this small paper has a lesson for physicians at large, pediatricians and those who deal with children, and in fact, adults as well. And that is that a diagnosis is lived through the patient's eyes, and the perception of what that diagnosis means comes from the patient. Scarlet fever may mean one thing to me. It may mean something else to the patient. While that patient may be technically incorrect in their assumptions and their beliefs about how deadly, for instance, or how dangerous the disease is, it doesn't make them any less real to the patient. And so my job as a physician is to elicit if these belief systems that are maybe incorrect and not accurate with the current day are there, and to if they are there, to disabuse the patient of them and comfort them in the fact that, for instance, scarlet fever, while it does have its complications, much like strep throat, and it is not a pleasant disease to have, is not the deadly disease that Laura Ingalls Wilder writes about.
Dr. Beth Tarini, University of Michigan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, a new study finds Americans are less healthy than people in many other high-income nations. We'll explore the reasons behind America's health disparities. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. Maybe you drive by a big state-of-the-art hospital every day on your way to work. Maybe you're lucky enough to have comprehensive medical insurance. And maybe you enjoy many other advantages, a well-paying job, a nice home. But despite those and other advantages of living in the USA, we are getting sicker and we are dying earlier than our counterparts in other developed affluent nations. That's the conclusion of a report from the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine. It's called U.S. Health in International Perspective: Shorter Lives, Poorer Health. One of the members of the panel behind this report joins us now in the studio. Dr. Anna Diaz-Rue is a professor at the University of Michigan. She chairs the Department of Epidemiology at the School of Public Health. And also joining the conversation is Kate Cohn-Parrott. Kate is the president and CEO of the Greater Detroit Area Health Council. She's helped shape healthcare reform at local and state levels, and that includes serving as a healthcare consultant to the State House of Representatives. Welcome to both of you. It's very good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Diaz-Rue, I'm going to start with you because you were part of the team that pulled this report together. The bottom line conclusion to this big report seems to be that we Americans really are not measuring up well in terms of health and longevity when you stack us up against other high-income countries. Fair enough?
Yeah, that's true. So what the report finds is that despite the fact that the U.S. is a very wealthy country and that it spends more than any other country on health care, it does substantially worse than many other high-income countries on a number of health indicators.
And you were studying diseases, injuries, and behaviors, right?
That's right. So we found that this health disadvantage, as we call it, is present across the entire life course, from very early in life through adolescence in young people, especially it pronounced before age 50. Other reports had documented a health disadvantage for older adults, but this is the first report to find that this disadvantage extends across the whole age range.
I have to suspect that as the data was coming in, it was quite a jolt to those of you putting that together. It certainly, I think, would jolt most Americans' view of where we stand in the world.
Yeah, I think on some level, we did know from other reports that the U.S., for example, does poorly on infant mortality. We've known that for a long time compared to other countries. But I think what was striking about this report was that it extended across the whole life course mm-hmm. and across very different kinds of health conditions. So shorter lives and higher prevalence of illness and rates of injury and many different kinds of health problems. I mean,
Yes, in fact, I see it when we, I want to review this before we go to Kate. Among there were 16 peer nations. Give us just a sampling of some of the nations, Anna.
Well, we compared the U.S. to all the Western countries of Western Europe, okay, and Australia and Canada and Japan. And if you look at the age-specific mortality rates, the U.S. is systematically at the bottom of that list. I mean, number 15, 16, 17 across the whole age span. So it's quite striking.
And we were at or near the bottom in, there were nine key areas of health, I see. There was infant mortality and low birth weight, injuries and homicides, teen pregnancies and STDs, HIV and AIDS, obesity and diabetes, heart disease, chronic lung disease, and disability. Kate Cohen-Parrott, from where you sit as head of the Greater Detroit Area Health Council, do these findings surprise you?
No, actually, they don't surprise me. I wish that they did, but they don't.
And why not?
Well, you know, as Anna just pointed out, the whole question about infant mortality is something that we've known for a very long time. And I can remember years ago when I first heard that statistic, and I have to, at that point in time, it really did startle me, because that was not something that I was aware of. You know, people I knew had babies, and they had healthy pregnancies, and the babies lived. And I remember making that comment about 4 or 5 years ago, and one of the people who was at an event I was speaking at was a pediatrician, an obstetrician delivering babies in the city of Detroit, and he said to me, you know, come with me on my rounds and meet the people who, you know, that I'm treating and taking care of, and you will have your eyes wide opened, because that's, you know, we are dealing with a whole different situation in Detroit than what you're used to in, you know, in the suburbs.
Although I did note in the report, and Anna, you could kind of take us across that, this is not only the poor and the uninsured, but these were Americans who are insured,
right,
college-educated, high income. And I was struck by this, even people who are engaged in healthy behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So why – I'm going to turn this to both of you then. What do you think is behind this? Why are we as a nation lagging so far behind our peer countries? Anna?
Well, so the panel considered a number of different possible explanations using the data that we have available, mm-hmm, which has some limitations, but it's a good starting point. So the first thing that people think of, well, it's health care, access to health care that's making the difference. We know that the U.S. has, you know, a larger uninsured population, less affordable care, less coordinated care, often less emphasis on prevention within health care. And certainly these factors may be contributing to some of the difference, but not all of it. Certainly not all of it, and probably not a large portion.
Hmm.
So then we also considered things like, well, social and economic factors. And these factors are very important, because we know that there are very large differences in health across the socioeconomic spectrum. And the U.S. has more inequality than other high-income countries, higher relative rates of poverty, less safety nets. And these things contribute also. And the disadvantage is greatest for people at the lower end of the spectrum. But as you noted, there are studies that have shown that this disadvantage is present even among the insured, wealthy white Americans who have higher rates of chronic illness, for example, than their peers in other countries. So behavioral factors certainly play a role as well, possibly. Although that begs, Americans tend to be more sedentary in general and have worse diets. So the data is hard to compare across countries, but there are certainly some behaviors on which the U.S. does worse than other countries. But that sort of begs the question, well, why? You know, mm-hmm, what's driving those patterns that the whole country is generally doing worse? And that points to thinking about, which the report highlights, well, what are some of the more environmental policy kinds of factors that we have to start thinking about in order to address this problem?
And that's your area, Kate, especially here in Michigan. What are your thoughts as to why these statistics are so depressing?
Well, I have a couple different thoughts. So I'd like to tell you a little story. Probably 6 or 7 years ago, a very good friend of mine moved to Germany, her and her family, her husband and 2 children. And about 8-9 months after they had been there, I happened to be in Germany, had the occasion to visit them. And I was shocked when I saw them, because they were thinner than they had been. And these are people who were not obese or overweight, but they were thinner and they looked much healthier. And we talked about that at the time, and they said, you know, we think we actually eat or consume more food than we did in the past when we were back in the States, but we ride our bikes, we walk into town and do our shopping, through walking, and we don't eat processed food. They felt that the whole environment, their access was markedly different. And they, felt much healthier because of that. So personally, that's a personal story that I experienced, and I think that does have an impact. The other thing, we've done some studies here, and again, I'm talking about the city of Detroit. There are zip codes in the city of Detroit that do not have sit-down restaurants. They only have fast food restaurants. And Detroit, the city of Detroit itself, has the highest per capita rate of fast food restaurants, certainly in the state, if not in the country. So, I think our prevalence of eating fast food and so forth is drives, some of those statistics. Previously, I used to run the healthcare programs for Chrysler, and we had done a study at the time, this was back in 2004, looking at what was driving up our costs, our healthcare costs, and we quickly recognized that the behaviors and the lifestyles of our employees was one of the key factors. Our costs were, obviously higher because of the fact that our population didn't necessarily exercise. And this is not just the Chrysler population.
Sure.
We were able to take this out, more broadly into the community.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And we're talking today with Kate Cohn-Parrott, President and CEO of the Greater Detroit Area Health Council, and Dr. Anna Diaz-Rue, who is a professor at U of M, the Department of Epidemiology. And we're looking at a report that actually Dr. Diaz-Rue was part of putting together, a report from the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine. It's called U.S. Health in International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health. And the bottom line of this report is that as a nation, Americans, we are just not stacking up in terms of health and longevity when we compare to our peer countries, other affluent countries. And it certainly seems, Anna, that you found this is not a matter of throwing money at this, because as you pointed out, we spend more than all these other countries, yet we're so much less healthy and living shorter lives.
Yeah, that's right. I think we have to, one of the recommendations of the report is that we have to look more broadly at what some of the determinants of this difference might be. And for example, take a look at what policies other countries may be implementing that could have health benefits that we're not taking advantage of. And I think we have to be aware as a society that many of the decisions that we make in terms of how we're going to do things may have health implications that we don't think about. For example, the U.S. has developed in a way that is highly dependent on automobile transportation for all sorts of transportation, for commuting, and that has influenced the way our cities have developed, the way our neighborhoods have been designed. And that has implications for physical activity and walking behaviors.
Sure, stack that up to Kate's friends in Germany.
Exactly related to what Kate was saying. If you look at the rates of active commuting in terms of whether people walk or cycle to work in the U.S., it's dramatically lower than in many European countries. And that has implications for injuries, for example, automobile-related injuries, which is another area in which the U.S. does quite poorly. And these things sort of reinforce each other, right? Because if you have an environment that's not conducive to being active, then social norms develop that people aren't active because it's just not the way that people behave. And
meaning it's a second nature to jump in your SUV to go three blocks to pick up your kids at school.
Exactly. And these things become reinforced. So the question is, how do you break that cycle? And there are many different ways you can break it, but certainly thinking about what some of the, higher level policy factors might be and what, how some of the decisions that we have been making may have unintended health consequences, I think is one of the things that comes out of this report.
And what do you want to add to that, Kate?
There's absolutely no question about that. And I believe that we've been too politically correct sometimes and not wanting to have some of these difficult discussions with people. I've noticed that here in Michigan, the Department of Community Health has recently been running some advertisements about obesity. And I think that the message they're portraying is a positive but a tough message for people to listen to. And I think we need to do more of that.
What kind of message is that for those who maybe haven't seen this?
Yeah, so what I've heard, they've been radio ads, and they've been encouraging people, telling them, for every pound you carry on, that's a couple extra hours of your life that you're giving up.
I have heard those, yes.
Okay, I do think that's a tough message, but I think it's a powerful message. And it's one that I think our society needs to start listening to, and maybe we need to be a little less politically correct in some of this dialogue.
Well, we had to get blunt as a nation in conversations about smoking, and it has taken time, but I consider the way smoking is regarded today in 2013 versus when I was growing up and the ashtray on the kitchen table was full because my dad smoked several packs a day, and so did most everybody he knew. So that finally has moved. It isn't eradicated by any means, but so we can affect change when the right set of circumstances presents itself. And I'm taking it that you're hoping that this report from the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine might help prod people. Do you have a lot of hope it will, Anna?
Well,
you have kind of a look on your face.
Well, I think the findings are so stark that I think it really has called people's attention. And, you know, there's really a problem here. And the other important thing is that, as Kate mentioned, you know, we've known some of this for a while, but mm-hmm. it hasn't really, you know, gotten into people's consciousness, at least not mm-hmm. in terms of the public as much. And also, unfortunately, it's a problem that has been getting worse over time. I mean, if you look at the trends in some of the where the U.S. ranks with respect to other countries on these various age mortality rates for different ages, you see it falling lower and lower and lower. As you noted, we can change things. I mean, one of the reasons we've been successful in reducing smoking rates is because we haven't only told people that they need to quit smoking, but we've also done a number of policy initiatives, legislation, mm-hmm. that has affected the way in which smoking is advertised, you know, tobacco is advertised, and has really changed the social norms around smoking. And that has, you know, fed into people smoking less. And so, in the same way, you know, this increase in obesity that we've been seeing, we've somehow created that. I mean, this isn't a natural thing that has happened, you know, just as a function of human nature. It's a function of the way of the way that we've organized things in our society, and so we can change that.
So, Kate Cohen-Parrott, especially since you have served as a healthcare consultant for Michigan's House of Representatives, what kinds of policy changes or adjustments do you feel would help make a difference in this pretty dismal situation?
I guess when you look at some of the things that are covered on benefit plans and so forth, there are ways to structure benefit plans, and you can do some of this legislatively that would, you know, would allow people to who live healthier lives to pay less towards the premiums for health care. There are certainly many, many things that have happened in the Affordable Care Act that are very positive, one of them being that, you know, health policies or health insurance is supposed to cover preventive care going forward mm-hmm. for free. But what we need to do with that, because just because you offer that coverage without a cost to the participant doesn't mean they're going to take advantage of it. So I think we need to get into some types of legislative policies that promote education for people to understand the medical system, the healthcare system, to help them understand the need and the necessity to practice preventive care. And I really think that we need to get into doing things where we are really rewarding and supporting primary care versus necessarily specialty care that we do today.
Anna, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's important to also note that, in addition to what Kate was saying, is that, you know, the U.S. has national health objectives, many of which address the conditions mm-hmm. for which we found the health disadvantage. And we know, I mean, there are a number of strategies that have been recommended by various task forces, preventive services task force, et cetera. We know certain things that we can do to try to improve, you know, health behaviors, mm-hmm. change environments, say, in schools, so to make the kids more active and eat healthier, and a number of other things that work and that we have to perhaps implement more vigorously than we have. And if they haven't worked, well, we need to step back and think about, well, why haven't they worked?
Mm-hmm. And right? What should be done?
Exactly.
Great thoughts and great insights. We want to thank both of you for joining us, Dr. Anna Diaz-Rue, who is the professor at the University of Michigan, chairing the Department of Epidemiology in the School of Public Health, and Kate Cohen-Parrott, who's the president and CEO of the Greater Detroit Area Health Council. Thanks to both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is great.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. The program today engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Maya Friedman, and Austin Davis. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.